Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's April 1st, 2013, and this is episode 366. So today, I'm happy to be sitting here again with Don Komarechka, and you probably recall Don from a month or so ago when we had a chat on this podcast, but also, if you listen to TWIP, Don's also one of the co-hosts over there, so we chat a lot, and I'm looking forward to talking with Don today about printing. So welcome to the show, Don.
Thank you very much for having me back, Martin.
So my pleasure. It's always nice to talk. So we chatted after the interview that we did a month or so ago about, you know, because we're both very passionate printers, and I'm really looking forward to talking. It was your idea to have a talk about printing, but I, the moment you said it, I thought, oh yeah, that'll be great, because, you know, whenever we're talking on TWIP, if we're doing hangouts and things where you can see, I always see those beautiful triptych gallery wraps behind you and everything. So it's going to be a bit of fun to talk today.
And it's interesting, too. You think about, the number of printers out there. Passionate photographer does not ever equal passionate printer. Mm. And it's fun that both of us have sort of a similar outlook towards both photography and printing. And to get us together can bounce some ideas back and forth and maybe inform some of the audience as to things that they should look out for, how to do it themselves, and, well, how to do it right, actually, would be the biggest thing we can get out of this conversation. So let's hope we get there.
Absolutely, yeah. So we've got a few bullet points, and I'll remind the audience before we jump into it. I'll drop a list of roughly the sort of things that we've talked about in the show notes. There won't be a manuscript because this isn't scripted, and I'll also any photographs and things that we mention, I'll try and grab them and put them into the show notes as well. So if you want to, and links and things, if you want to go over to mbp.ac/366. All of that will be there on the blog. So you better reference that as we talk if you need to. But so Don, why do you print?
Oh, man, you're giving me the hard question. it's funny because I figured that's the way that we should start off. In the digital era, you know, printing things seems somewhat passe. You know, when was the last time that I ever printed a 4x6? Mm. I don't know if I ever did, unless to put it into an album from when I was a child. But I don't think printing really means printing for a photo album these days, because that's disappeared for a large part. Mm. I think now it's printing for enjoyment, you know, to put something on a wall, to have something on a large scale that can, you know, be a conversation piece in your house, to add to your decor, to be almost like some of the pieces that I print and that I've got up in my office here tell a lot about who I am and about my career as a photographer, my enjoyment, my likes and dislikes with photography. You can see that there's no pictures of people in my office, so it kind of gives you a feel of the kind of work that I do. Mm. And I also say that printing is sort of the final step in an image, because when I go to print, I've learned through mistakes that if I'm ready to print something, I double and triple check everything, because mm-hmm. if I hit that print button, I'm spending money. Yeah. And it'll come out and I'll see a dust spot in the sky that I had missed, and it's just going to bother me endlessly unless I just scrap it and reprint it. Yep. So I think that printing as well will help me learn to sort of edit my pictures, be a perfectionist, really, when it mm. comes down to it. I don't know if you feel the same way, Martin. Why do you print?
Well, I certainly feel the same way. I think, you know, I totally agree with everything that you said there. And the another thing that you made me think of is that not only does it make me very critically check the, you know, the dust spots and things like that, but also critical sharpness. I mean, I've always prided myself on how sharp I managed to get my images, and I've noticed sometimes that, you know, even if you think, you know what, this is so good that I'm gonna keep it in my collection, but there's, say you've got two birds in the shot and the one at the back is maybe a meter behind the first one, and I'm talking cranes, red crown cranes here, big birds, and if you try to go too shallow on the depth of field, it's very easy to get the back of the two birds out of focus very slightly. And until you print it relatively large, it looks fine for the web. But as the moment you print it, if the bits that you expect to be sharp aren't, it bugs the hell out of you. So I think that the thing that you made me think of was it also helps you to hone your craft, because when you start printing and things aren't quite as sharp as you really thought they should be, you think, oh damn, I've got to get better at doing this, you know. And so I think it helps you to improve your photography from the shooting stage as well, and not just after the event.
And printing for yourself is one thing too. Like I'd mentioned, printing my own artwork up in my office here. But I know that you print for other people as well. You'll sell your artwork too. Is that correct?
Yeah, you do as well though, right?
I certainly do, yeah. And I think that when I print my artwork, I mean, I'm even more critical when I'm handing it to somebody else than if I'm making it for myself.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's a huge thing when your artwork is complete, you know, from the moment that you took it in camera to the, you know, all the processes or whatever you decide to do to edit it, maybe you don't touch it much at all, and then carrying through the entire printing process. Now, there's a lot of steps involved in that, and we're going to get into exactly what's required. And like you had mentioned, Martin, I think it helps you hone your skill as a photographer overall.
Mm. Yeah, and I know exactly what you mean. If I'm going to be putting something on my own wall, because I'm a big believer in living with your work, and I don't print everything that I want to live with for a while because I don't have the wall space for that. Well, I do, but I'm only allowed to use a very small amount of my wall space. Like my wife won't let me hang anything downstairs. So my office slash studio is the only place that I can hang anything. So I don't fill the walls, but if I'm going to be printing something just to live with, I'll maybe I'll tack it up here in front of me and just see whether I really like it or not for a while. Then I am not so critical. I will, you know, I want the image to be perfect, but if I get, say, a little bit of a scuff mark every so often, especially with roll paper, we both work with large format printers, and they take rolls, and sometimes, you know, you can get a little bit of a weird bend or a kink in a bend in the paper, and the way it sort of feeds through the heads can sometimes with these big printers make the heads actually scuff the paper just a tad.
Because they're sitting so close to the print head surface, if there's any deviation in the smoothness of it beyond whatever is specified, then the print head can actually rub against the paper, and you're right, you get these weird scuffs that just sort of ruin the look.
Right, and so if I'm going to be sending it out to a customer, obviously I'm going to make sure that if anything like that happens, if I get a spot that's not supposed to be there, I'll just bin it and start again. But if it's for myself, I'm not quite as critical. I'll sometimes still use it as the, I'm going to live with this print for a while. Because 9 times out of 10, when I do that, I actually just tack it up there, or, you know, I'm making holes in it anyway. So I'm just printing really for the sheer fun of it and to live with the image. But if I'm going to be sending something out to a customer, it's got to be 100% or it goes in the bin. And that's actually, you know, I know it's easier for you because you have, I just found out that you're using PC. So you have the accounting module as well.
Oh yeah, that's fun.
Yeah. So if I want to use the accounting module, I have to crank up Parallels and open Windows, because Canon, in their ultimate wisdom, bless them, decided that the Mac operating system wasn't important enough to create a version of the accounting module for in their printer drivers. So,
if you're spending the premium on a Mac, then you really don't care about accounting all that much, do you?
Well, that's a good way to look at it, but it annoys the hell out of me. What you can do is that with these big printers, you enter in how much the roll of paper cost you. You enter in the amount that you paid for the inks, and then it will actually, it'll tell you exactly to within point something cents, or in my case, yen, exactly how much that print cost you to output.
And only after it's been printed, though, because it can estimate beforehand, but afterwards it's got like a per, like picoliter or whatever it is, measurement of the ink it actually needed to use in the print. Right. And it's kind of fun to see. It's like, oh, well, that one cost me, $20 to print. And well, this one, the same size, cost me, you know, $30. Well, right. It's because it used more ink and all this type of stuff. So you get to see sort of the nitty gritty behind the scenes as to exactly how much, you know, where your ink is going, which I think is useful to anybody. If you've got a desktop printer printing documents, documents in anything, your ink just disappears. It's kind of nice to have some accountability of where it goes.
Oh, yeah.
So let's get into this as sort of a you're a photographer and you've got a great picture that you want to print on your wall. So where do we start? I think that the basic point is how big do you want to make it? Mm. How big is that print going to be on your wall? And how big could you make it based on the type of image that you've got?
Mm. So when I moved to this new place a couple of years ago, almost 3 years ago now, one of the main reasons that I moved, the main reason was because I was about to throw in my old day job and I needed more space. I needed a bit of studio room and stuff like that. But one of the big things that I was really looking forward to was buying a large format printer. Until then, I'd been using the Pro 9500, not the Mark II, the original one. Still got it. It's a great printer. But I wanted to print larger. I wanted to be able to sell larger prints. The Pro 9500 goes up to 13x19. Because I'm actually on the third floor of a wooden structure building, I was advised by Canon not to go for the IPF 8000, which is the 42-inch printer, I think it is. But I was able to, in my third floor, to put an IPF 6350, which is basically a 24-inch wide printer. And
for anybody that's not sure, like you're saying a big printer, Martin, moving that up, consider like an antique three-seat sofa and trying to move that.
Oh, yeah. You know, when I scrimped, I didn't pay the extra so many $100 or so that they needed to actually come and set it up for me. And I regretted it the moment I started. I downloaded the manuals and it talks about when you actually are going to be carrying the printer around. And it says you need three people to carry it, to lift the printer onto the stand. And I thought, no way, you know. And then when it arrived, I'd already started to worry about this. I'd got someone that I was perhaps going to have someone come around and give me a hand with it. But when it arrived, they opened the back of the van and it was on a wooden pallet. You know, you expect printers to come on in boxes.
This delivered on a forklift.
It was literally delivered. It was a wooden pallet was basically the base of the printer box. And they take a cardboard, very thick, sturdy cardboard cover off to reveal the printer and all of the stuff. But it's actually sitting on a wooden pallet. So I had to slip the guys, the delivery men, like $20 each to help them, to have them help me to bring it up to the third floor. And then after I'd got it out of the box, my wife, who's like a 50-kilogram little Japanese girl, was basically had to try and help me to get it up onto the stand. We managed it, but it was heavy. So yeah, these things are hefty printers. Mine takes roll paper up to 24 inches. And that means that at the same aspect ratio as most digital SLRs will spit out, which is 3x2, it means that the largest native print that I can create is 24x36. So that is, you know, that's one of the print sizes that I like to do. I've got a couple of them on my walls here that are that print at that size. I rarely print with to all of the edges. Normally I'll add a border. I've got a spreadsheet on my blog somewhere that basically calculates how much above center I want to put it, because I rarely print in the center. We find it more aesthetically pleasing to have the print slightly above center. Plus, it gives you a bit of room to sign the print as well. But yeah, I mean, what sort of stuff do you do, Don? What sizes do you print up to? I've seen those triptychs and need to be getting into that myself.
Well, okay, well, and we'll get into triptychs too. But let's take a look at how big you can go, because this is an interesting question for a lot of photographers. The average digital SLR right now, let's say it's around 20 megapixels. Some are under, some are over, but 20 is a good even number for us to sort of base this judgment on. And I've got a print sitting right above me here that was taken with a Canon 5D Mark II, which is 21 megapixels. And I've printed it as an 80x20. Mm. And that's one of the largest prints that I've made, and we'll get into some of the tricks to printing that large. But printing it in that ratio means that I've cropped like two-thirds of the image away, a third off the top, a third off the bottom. So I'm dealing with maybe around 7 megapixels, and I can get something that big of a print. It's not like if I were to nose up to it, yeah, I'm going to see a little degradation in quality. But at a print that size, you're not going to nose up to it. So there's a lot of things to factor into this as far as viewing distance and if you're going to be framing it, what kind of material it's on. And I'll generally say that I print for the space that's required. You know, I've done a lot of prints too that are vertical, like almost like a vertical panorama, like a thin sliver of an image. I've done this with waterfalls. I've done this with some water droplet macro shots and all that kind of stuff. And everybody, you know, these sell well because you think about people that have that little sliver of wall in their house that, you know, no photo really looks good on.
Yeah.
And so it's a good selling point to have those kinds of things around, and it's pretty easy to get that done. I typically avoid a 36 by 24 or a 3:2 aspect ratio shot. A lot of my stuff I'll crop into weird sizes. Because I look at the image as a whole and I think, well, maybe, you know, if I take an inch off of this side, then the composition's a little bit better. Or if I print something square, then, you know, it works really well with this particular image. I might make it a little bit more panoramic. And because I'm in control of the printing process, I'm not slave to printing it as a 11:14 or an 8:10 or a 30:20 or any of these sizes that a typical print house would offer you. You know, especially when I print on canvas too, because I don't have to worry about custom framing costs. Then I can, if the print looks great as a 22:20 because I want an extra 2 inches on the sides because that helps with the composition, then that's what I print. And and that's what I end up producing. And the artwork is sort of, it's more unique in that sense because it doesn't sort of fit any mold per se. So I'll print anything and everything. Now, I've got the same printer as you, Martin. I've got the IPF. I've got the 6300. I think you've got the 6350, unless you've upgraded to the 6400.
No, it's the 50, but it, and just so the people know, the only difference...
We're talking Chinese here, yeah.
The only difference is that the 6350 has a hard disk in it, so you can actually store print jobs on the printer and just rerun them from the printer dialog. But the amount of times I have used it, but the amount of times that you need that are so few that, you know, it's really not worth the extra. I think it's like $50 or $100 or so more, maybe a little bit more than that. But it's useful to have if you've got the budget to pay the extra. But I don't think it's necessary.
At least not for a fine art printer. If you were doing a batch job and say if it was a large print house that was doing this and they were doing a large print run for a big client and they needed to keep the files handy, that would make sense. But not so much for my use, so I opted not to get it.
Yeah, now, I didn't need it either, so I'm with you.
Exactly, except you bought it.
Well, the thing is, I didn't really know how much I'd use it, and I've got this thing that my mum as a kid, and the listeners will know this, but she always used to say, if you're gonna have a big one. So I generally will. I would have bought the 42-inch if I could have put it up here, and I probably would have enjoyed using it as well because there are some limitations, but back to what you were saying there about the sizes. I definitely don't try to avoid 3:2. If my images are 3:2s, then I'll go with that. But I'm not scared of cropping a bit either as well. And I actually, what you were just saying reminded me that issue 2 of Photograph, the Craft and Vision digital magazine, that it's just issue 2's just out a month or so ago. The article that I have in there I've got a regular column and it's called The Art of the Print. And the article that I have in there for the second issue was called Why Resolution Matters But Doesn't. And the point was, I went through a lot of stuff. I mean, I've got a photograph in there, and I'll put this into the blog post, but I've got a photograph from a friend of mine in the Netherlands who basically, he works at a company that bought two of my images to have them printed at 5 meters wide. And so I've got a photograph of his cafeteria at their new office with one of my flower shots at 5 meters wide. Now, the point of this article, the first part of it, Why Resolution Matters, goes into this, because I actually, they had to work with me, and luckily they wanted my art and not just anybody's art. And so they worked with me, because the two images that they originally picked were 10 point something. They were 5D Mark I images. And so the long and short of it was 10 megapixels isn't enough. We need
12, I think, out of the camera.
Was it 12? Yeah. 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 So they said it's not enough. They said we need 20 megapixels. So I said, okay, well, fine. If that's the case, if you want to work with me, I can recommend a few other shots. And we found two others that they were happy to use. They weren't their first choice, though. But, you know, at 5 meters, you do have to get a little bit picky. And even then, obviously, you're pushing it a little bit to take a 21 megapixel file up that big. But you're not going to be necessarily looking at it with your nose against the print, which is what a lot of photographers generally do.
And let's take a look at billboards, too. If you've got like a billboard image, that does not need to be of any significant resolution.
Right. Because you're looking at it from so far away.
So far away. And it's going to be at such a small percentage of your field of view, you know, it's like you'd never be able to nose up to that.
Right.
And those are printed far bigger than 5 meters across.
Yeah.
And so you're right. Resolution matters and it doesn't. And there's so many factors involved in figuring that out.
Well, that was exactly what the second part of this article was talking about. In that, I mean, I finish it with a picture of me holding up with a big cheesy grin on my face, holding up a 24 by 48 inch print of, again, it was a 16 megapixel file that I cropped top and bottom to make a 1x2 panorama, and that ended up at like 10 megapixels. Now, if I print it out without doing anything to it, it doesn't look great. It's, you know, it's a little bit too soft. It's acceptable for if you walk away from it, it's acceptable, but the reason that it doesn't matter is because even if you don't have enough megapixels or enough resolution to print it natively that large, there are tools that we can use to enlarge or embiggen, I love the word embiggen, a photograph. And one of them is, there's a couple that people might know of. I mean, the old one, Genuine Fractals, actually became Perfect Resize.
And I use that one as well.
Yeah, and they're both, that's now at version 7.5. And 7.5 actually brings a few nice touches over version 7.
I'm using 7, so tell me what the benefits are.
Well, it's just a more intuitive interface. I've not used it enough yet. I've only used it a couple of times in my actual print, and I only upgraded over the last couple of weeks, and I've only done a little bit of printing since then. But the interface is a little bit more intuitive, and there's one downside with it that I need to check if 7 was like this, and if it was, I'd be a little bit unhappy. But I noticed that with 7.5, the default is that it makes all of your images into 8-bit images, and instead of maintaining 16-bit, which is not good. So you have to go in and to the preferences and change that to 16-bit as the default before you really start using the plugin. But apart from that, you know, the good side, it's a more intuitive interface. And as far as the quality is concerned, I was never dissatisfied with the original 7. So that's not really going to be a big deal, I don't think. But I'm sure that they're saying that the algorithms are better and all of that. And they may well be, but I haven't tested it enough to say, you know, yes or no.
Well, let's talk about that. The algorithms. What algorithms are needed to make an image bigger? What secret sauce is hidden within this program that, say, Photoshop doesn't have, or that your camera can't do inside of itself?
Well, I'm going to jump in and with a bit of a caveat here, in that the other bit of software that I was thinking of was Alien Skin's Blow Up 3. And I've seen on their website, I've never really looked into this on the Perfect or on One's website. So you may be able to jump in here, Don, but on the Alien Skins website, they talk about how they take the elements of an image, you know, like a hair or anything where you've got a line between one tone and another or one color and another. And they actually draw like vector graphics around all of the elements. And then so that's like Illustrator, Adobe's Illustrator. And then they blow it up mathematically. And then they'll redraw the image. And I don't think that's how Perfect Resize are doing it. But do you know how the algorithms work in Perfect Resize, Don?
Well, I think that there's a certain amount of secrecy in that, right? Because if that was well known to everybody, then there would be a dozen companies that do the same thing. Mm. I do know that the original name of the software, Genuine Fractals, gives some clue as to how the algorithms work using fractal algorithms. And that's using repeating patterns and using definable patterns. And a definable pattern would be something like a vector, you know, where you can see a curve in the image, and if that curve is calculatable by any measure, then that curve can be extrapolated on a much larger scale, so that when you do scale things up, any of those mathematically definable patterns within the image, the math can take it to a larger scale than the basic resize options within Photoshop would be able to do. Yeah. That's sort of how I understand it. And I know that there's a lot of fuzzy logic in that. You know, there's so many unknowns as to how it works. But the basic gist of it is that it uses math to make things better.
Yeah. So, and when you look at the image afterwards, if you take a look at an image that you've blown up to print really big, then some of the elements in that image can actually look a little bit wacky. They look like they've been painted like an oil painting.
Yeah, but, because things look very rounded.
Yeah, but then when you print it, they look beautiful. And so, you know, this resolution thing, it's obviously it matters to a degree, and you're always going to want to try to capture images with as high a resolution as you can. And that's why, I'm all for cameras like the D800, and I can't wait for Canon to bring something else out like that. But it doesn't mean that we necessarily need to run out or beat ourselves up or get online and start to beat everyone else up that wants to get a higher resolution camera. Because, you know, if you're happy with what you've got, and we all have better cameras than we've ever had in the past. So, you know, if you're happy with that, then there's no reason to beat yourself up about it, because there's pretty much always something you can do to print larger. And I mean, both Don and I are getting pretty big prints out of the stuff that we've got. And some of it, as you're hearing, is not that small. They're not, like 7 megapixels that's printed out 80 inches wide, as you just mentioned, Don. That's pretty impressive. So I think people can be happy to understand that although having more resolution is ideal, it's not going to be a huge factor if you still want to print pretty big.
So if you want to print big and you have... Well, you don't have the space for, say, a 2-foot printer that takes a 24-inch carriage of roll paper, because as we talked, you know, those things are not easy to move. Mm. If you've got, say, maybe a Canon 9000 or whatever the Epson equivalent would be, or anything of that nature, a smaller that can print on a 13x19. Is that as big as you can print? Like, what are the options of somebody that's got a printer like that, but they want to fill a wall with a piece of their artwork? 19 inches by 13 inches is not big enough to do that. Mm. And even from the printers that we have, say if we want to print something that's bigger than 36 by 24 or something of that nature, how do we get bigger? Are there options?
Well, there's the triptych that we talked about a moment ago. And that's basically where you print the image in three sections. And it doesn't have to be three. It can be two sections. It can be four. But obviously from the name of triptych, the tripart there, it means that it's a three-part image. And you basically take the image, split it into three, and create three different... in your case, I saw on your wall beautiful canvas gallery wraps. And the triptych is one way that you can do that for sure.
And the one behind me, I think, is 60 by 30 or 60 by 32 or something like that in size. So that's one way to get around it. Yeah. Now, it's interesting, too, because when you think that you can take an image and split it into pieces, you can start to get a little bit creative with the way that works. Mm. And there's something that I haven't fully explored yet, but it came to me maybe a couple of weeks ago. And I've got an image that I can make that might fit this. So imagine this, if you will. A canvas that is two pieces, but they're not sort of rectangles side by side. Mm. They're interlocking L shapes.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of them will be taken during the daytime of a scene, and one of them will be taken during the nighttime of the scene without moving the camera and having them interlock. That's sort of one of my next projects. Taking a print and making it into an L shape on canvas is not the easiest thing. I'm sure there's challenges there, but you know, it's thinking outside the box, you know, taking the image that would be on your computer would look entirely differently than a print done in that particular method, and taking an image and splitting it into pieces, whether it's a, you know, three panels side by side or four panels.
Yeah.
You can have, I've seen some people do this where they print it on an angle so that it can go up a staircase framed on an angle, but it's aligned so that it looks straight.
Yeah,
and there's all sorts of creative ways for you to play around with that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you can print an image as sort of a four panel. So like maybe it makes a square and you can make it bigger that way. Yeah. And that fills out wall space very, very well. So on a small printer, you can easily fill in that space. It's not that you can't afford a bigger printer. Like sometimes there's a cost commitment to that. The bigger printers are expensive, and we're going to get into cost in a minute. But sometimes you just don't have the room.
Yeah.
My first office, I've just moved into a bigger one, but my first office, that printer took up a good quarter of the room. Yeah. And you know, I was sort of questioning. It's like, man, is this going to fit when that box arrived? Just like you, Martin. I'm thinking, I don't know where I'm going to put this. Right. Is it going to go in the basement? Connected on like a wireless network or something like that. What am I going to do?
Yeah.
So at least there's options out there to get a bigger print.
Yeah. And the Canon printers also come with, I forget the name, it's something like Enlarge or something or other. Most printers come with software where even if you're just printing on paper, not necessarily gallery wraps as we're talking about, you can actually just split or print an image onto say six pieces of paper and stick them together if you wanted to. You know, there are ways to sort of splice images together and get larger ones. But, you know, I mean, having it outsourced, if you want to go really big, like when the guy that I mentioned earlier in the Netherlands came to me about the 5 meter wide mural, it's like, okay, well, obviously I'm not going to be able to provide that. So I just enabled them with the digital files. And yeah, you know, so there's always outsourcing. If you need to get something really big, or even if you want to just get a gallery wrap, it's not necessary to run out and buy a large format printer if you just want to try it. You know, so outsourcing is certainly something that we can consider, and we can talk about this a little bit more later, but.
Well, let's talk about this now because we're sort of getting into, you know, whether you want to do it yourself or have somebody else do it for you.
Yeah.
Okay. And so if I want to do it myself, there's a certain amount of risk involved because I'm buying my first big printer. I'm going to have to make mistakes because I'm going to have to learn, right? I'm going to print out test prints. I'm going to try different settings and see what the results are and compare things. And so if you were to go out and buy your own printer and you want to get the best results possible, you almost have to budget a couple of $100 in wasted paper and inks and of course time to figure out exactly how this works, how the print plugins work in Photoshop or the print drivers work in other applications, and of course calibration, which we'll get to in a minute as well. But so you mentioned, if it's way too big, you can go to somebody else. Do you lose any control when you go to somebody else? Like, is any of the large commercial printers going to be able to do a proper triptych for you? Or are they going to, are there corners that they cut that you wouldn't necessarily? Is having control over your artwork from beginning to end something that is valuable or a waste of time?
Oh, I think it's very valuable. That's why I have the printer. I remember Frederick Van Johnson on TWIP asking me a couple of times about, you know, why do it yourself? And one of the reasons is exactly that. I want to be able to control the process from start to finish. And I not only believe, you know, in the days of real, you know, gelatin printing, you know, the original film printing, I never did that myself, but the prints were called original prints. You know, when Ansel Adams goes down into his darkroom and actually starts printing, he was creating original prints, which means the artist creates the print. And I still believe that there's an element of that, and that's why I still mark a lot of the prints that I sell as original prints, because it's me, the person that made the photograph initially, who's taking it through to the print. And although I could have you press the button, I could have anyone press the button. The difference is that if the artist himself or herself actually goes through and creates that print, then it means that I'm doing all of the tweaking, I'm doing the soft proofing, I'm doing the spotting, I'm doing anything that needs to be done to that image to make it look as best as it can when it's printed. And then just because you're only pressing a button at the end is kind of irrelevant. It's really all of the love and care that went into Ansel Adams' prints, and obviously on a different scale. I'm not trying to say that I'm Ansel Adams in any way, but but all of that is there. And so I believe that there's value in the original print. But also, I mean, I do think that obviously there's color management to think about. If you outsource your work, you really need to get them, or at least work with a lab that will send you their ICC profiles so that you can plug them into Lightroom or Photoshop and actually do a bit of soft proofing and make sure that it's going to look as good as it can when it's printed. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but...
Before we get to that, there's just one other point that I want to mention. Yeah. So we've got a printer and we know that there's software that can make it bigger. We know that we can crop it and we can print it any size. But the media in which we print on is something that I think is very valuable to have your control. Because if you go to a commercial printer, you've got the choice of, okay, you want a photographic print or you want canvas. And they might give you a vague premium level of each. Mm. But you don't really know what you're actually printing on. And why does that matter? You know, I've got a number of different choices. I've got a nice satin photo paper that I quite like. I've got a metallic satin. Mm. I've got some watercolor papers. I've got canvas. And different images will look different on different types of media. Yeah. For example, a lot of my snowflake photographs get printed onto a metallic satin. It's sort of a subliminal shimmer that's not really noticeable. Like some metallics are very obtrusive and they really jump into your face, but this one's just a subtle little touch. Mm. And if I can choose to have a little extra oomph to my image based on the media that I choose for it,
yeah,
then I think that's part of having the control and choosing the way the artwork is finished, and printing your own artwork gives you that control as well. Well, what kind of papers do you print on, Martin?
Well, most people already know that I'm pretty much exclusively using Breathing Colors papers. They're live canvas. I love their Optica One, which is a beautiful. It's very similar to anyone's used Epson's Velvet fine art papers. Very similar to that. If I need a gloss, I rarely use gloss, but when I want to print with something on a gloss, I'll generally go for their, I think it's called Vibrance Rag, which is a beautiful Baryta gloss. It's very slightly textured. I've tried, because I've been working very closely with Breathing Color for a while, they sent me a whole bunch of a number of rolls of different types of paper to try when I was making the print. And I actually in making the print, and that's the book that I put out through Craft and Vision, the ebook. When I was writing that, they sent me a whole bunch of their papers to sample. And I did an image that is actually in making the print, where I've got them all lined up together. The sample image that I've used is literally just the targets that you print when you're calibrating the paper or profiling the paper. But the thing is that I really wanted to express on people with that photograph was that I put these, I think it was five different prints. They're gloss, they're very smooth glosses, and right through Optica One, they're matte paper, their fine art matte paper. And what I did was I put them in such a position where the light from the window was shining on them, and you can see it get progressively less reflective as you go along. So the really pure glossy paper with no texture is reflecting the light so much that it almost looks white in the image. And then as you go across to the matte, it gets progressively less and less reflective until you get to the two matte papers on the left side of the photograph, I think they are. And I'll find this photograph out and put it in the show notes. But as you get to the mattes, there is no reflection at all. So you can tell, I mean, what for me, one of the biggest things, especially if I'm going to be putting something under glass or perspex, that glass is going to add a certain amount of glossiness back to the image anyway. But if you have a gloss paper and put it under glass, then you're doubling the gloss effect. And so you get a lot of reflections. You've got to be really careful about where you hang a photograph like that.
But or spend a lot more on the glass. And that's like, I've got some prints that are made by with, you know, museum quality glass. And right. It is so expensive.
Oh, yeah.
It's far more expensive than the framing and the printing combined.
Right. So, I mean, I just think that until a few years ago, matte papers, the D-Max, the darkest black, the darkest tones that they can create, wasn't that low. It was, or high, I should say, probably. So, you know, you couldn't get really, really deep blacks with some of the original matte papers. And even now, if you buy like a really cheap matte paper, they don't have very deep blacks. But now, or even rich colors. But now the papers are like I was saying, I mean, Epson's Velvet Fine Art is a beautiful paper. From Canon, they actually rebrand Harney Mule papers. I used to use Harney Mule a lot. Until I fell in love with breathing color. But then, you know, Harney Mule is fine art. What is it? Photo rag, or I forget. Exactly.
That's what I use. The Harney Mule, the photo rag, Baryta. I forget exactly what the thickness of the paper that I have here is, but it's a beautiful cotton based paper. It's got a slight warm tone to it, but, and that works great for a lot of my nature images. And you know, cotton based papers have basically a natural neutral pH, and they won't there's no acidity to the paper. They won't degrade the image quality over time. And so there's a lot of different factors to consider. I mean, we could drill down like five different levels as to exactly why different papers work better for different cases. And I agree with everything that you've said, Martin, as far as the reflective options. I'm not a big fan of high-gloss papers myself.
No.
They really don't do much for me. Although I like a nice gloss coat on canvas. That seems to work well because there's no glass involved on that particular medium. I'd like to mention as well, you know, the different papers and technology for printing have come a long way, but it's still interesting to take a look at the way that we see the world. I mean, if you take a look at human vision and how many stops of dynamic range we have versus how many stops a camera can record, and then how many stops of dynamic range a computer monitor can display, and then a print can display, it's going down by huge amounts. I mean, on average, I did a bit of research into this. A print can display around 7.5 stops of dynamic range, and human vision is around 20 or 24 stops of dynamic range, depending on where you look. And that's like a huge order of magnitude. That's like multiple thousands of times more visual information we see versus what a print has. So it really becomes an art form to try and map what you see into a print and have it show up well. And there's a lot of inside knowledge that, you know, it really comes from just practice and experimentation. But color management is a big part of that as well. And we're going to get into that in 1 second, but there's one further point that I want to make. As far as how much does this cost? How much does your printer cost? I think when I bought mine, it was somewhere around $4,000 for the IPF 6300.
Wow. Mine was 270,000 yen. So that's at today's rate, that's about, I don't know, $2,800.
Well, that's pretty good.
I got a relatively good deal. As I said, I didn't pay for them to actually bring it in. I just paid for the delivery, which was quite cheap. But I did get a good deal. I did one of those. There's a website in Japan that gives you the best deals and everything there. And I mean, when did you buy yours, Dom? Was it like when it was relatively new still?
Immediately after the announcement, and they were in stock.
I generally jump on stuff like that, especially if I've got my eye on something and I don't mind paying a little bit of a premium to get that stuff, because then you get the best life out of the printer before the next one's released and you start feeling, oh no. But I was pretty slow to get mine. It had been on the market for a while, and so there was probably a few good deals around. And I know that B&H, if you live in the US, B&H, you generally have some pretty good deals on these printers as well. And of course, I mean, that leads us to the next part. One of the reasons why you can get a lot of printers so cheaply, and this is another reason why the larger format printers are not that cheap, because right now, apparently, inkjet ink for per gram or whatever it will be is actually more expensive than gold. and it literally, they charge, it's like the razor blade and the razor and the razor blade model. They'll throw a good razor at you for pretty much for free because they know that they've got you with the $20, $30 razor blades that you're going to have to buy afterwards. So
these printers take 12 ink tanks, correct?
Right, right.
And how much does each one cost?
They're here in Japan, I will pay about $120 per tank. So it costs, it costs well over $1,000 to fill these guys up. Now, the thing to note there, though, is that when you've got that, it's actually more economical. If I was to be using these little tiny, I don't know, 35 milliliter, that's probably even big. Some of the smaller or A3 plus 13x19 inch printers, they actually don't hold very much in the tanks at all. The printer that me and Don have here, these take, what are they? Are they 300 and... I forget, actually. 720 milliliters, or was it 300 and something?
I think it's... I think it might be less than that, actually. But because you're taking 12 of them, you know, the overall amount of ink that the printer has at its disposal is quite a lot larger than having a multi-purpose ink tank that holds, maybe 30 milliliters and it's only got, say, 6.
Yeah.
Where this has a heck of a lot more that allows you to play with. If you're filling up this printer, you can print for, at least on my workflow, I can print for maybe about 8 months.
Oh yeah.
On an ink tank. I mean, I'm not printing high volume stuff here. Mm. But it's not like you've got to replace it every month. It's not like it's going to be a huge expense for you.
Well, my printer came with, I'm going to have to try and check the actual amounts that, as we talk, I'll try and do this. But they come with half full tanks. They don't, because the ink is so expensive, when you buy these things, they come with like the first set of inks that they come with is like the cartridges are only about half full.
I think they're 90 milliliter cartridges when it first ships to you. And then when you buy like refills, they're 130, if I'm not mistaken.
Something like that. That sounds about right. But I am actually, for the majority of my inks, I'm actually still on the second cartridge. So I've replaced all of the cartridges, and I think probably around half of them are still on that second cartridge. So I'm really not using a lot of ink, really. And part of the reason is just because I travel so much that I don't get a chance to do as much printing as I would like, but I've still printed a hell of a lot with this. And so it's not like, although it can cost $1,000 or so to fill the thing up, it's not as though you're having to replace inks every month or so as you would with a smaller printer. So it actually works out more economical.
And what about paper? Of course, if you're buying a gigantic roll of 2-foot paper, it's not going to be the cheapest thing in the world. I know that some of the rolls that I've purchased have cost upwards of $500, depending on the type of material used. And now, for $500, you get like 100 feet of paper at 2 feet wide. It's not like you're, having the super prized possession where you now have to sell a print for $600 to make money on it.
Yeah.
You get a lot for what you pay for, but you have to put a fair amount of money up front, just like with the ink, but it's going to last you a long time.
Right. Well, I mean, I've got through a lot of rolls. I can't imagine maybe a good 4 or 5 rolls of matte. I'm looking on Breathing Colors website right now. Optica One for 24 foot wide rolls at 40 feet long are $129.60 for one roll. And then if you buy 3, it goes down to $107. I generally don't buy 3 at a time, but I will quite often buy 2 rolls at a time because for me, I have to have it shipped over from the US. And so it's easier to buy a lot of stuff together in one, just in one fell swoop. But I
with Breathing Color, I order in batches of three as well for that gives you a discount
of what, $60. So for the on the three. So I mean, it does. It's not cheap, like you say, but because you get so much paper here, you know. I mean, that's basically 80 square feet of paper. So that's a lot to be working with. So I generally will use that. I mean, some of the paper the normal, very thin sort of like copy paper, I've got rolls that are, I think, 120 feet long as well. I only use that for facing paper for when I ship my prints. I don't actually print on it. But I've got that rolls that are really long like that. But yeah, I mean, if you want to get into large format printing, then there is a little bit of initial outlay. It's definitely going to cost you more than it will to use a 13x19 printer. But I did a podcast a couple of years ago when I bought literally a very small, I think it's the MG 6130 or 6180 or something like that. It's a different number in the West, but literally just a $100 printer. Here in Japan, it was almost $200, but you can buy them for like just over $100 in a lot of places. It's only an A4 printer, but I remember testing that printer when I first got it. And if you take control of the color management, and you, even if you just tell the printer drive, you know, don't, in Lightroom, you say, I don't want to use the printer drivers. I want to specify a profile. Even if you take the time to just specify the profile yourself that comes with the printer, then you can actually get really, really good results just from, and that's only like six colors. So I think most printers these days, if you get something that's decent, I would certainly, even if you want to buy a printer, an A4 printer or a letter size printer, then just to try it, just to get your feet wet, then I would certainly be prepared to spend a lot more on or to replace ink cartridges more often, because these things have tiny print cartridges in them, but also you'll find that once you've started printing with those things, you'll probably end up upgrading and getting something bigger as well. But if you want to just get your feet wet and give it a try, those small printers will definitely give you a good entry level sort of. It gives you some experience with the printing at home.
What are you going to say? No, I was going to say, no matter what size of printer that you have, you know, you have to take some level of control. You mentioned that going into the driver and changing some settings in there to get better results. And the same is true on a small printer or a large printer. And the discussion of color management, I think, is one of the ones that we should end off on, because this is really how you get a good print. Whatever you see on your computer screen might look beautiful, but then if you go to print that without having a whole lot of control behind the scenes, you're going to get pretty miserable results. A lot of times I'll have some, like my students will come to me and they'll ask, you know, my prints are coming out dark. They look perfect on my computer screen. What's going on here? Why are my prints looking so wrong? Like, is there a step in this process that I'm missing? And yes, the step that they're missing would be color management. It's funny because a lot of times computer monitors are way too bright. You know, they're made very contrasty and they look great if you're watching a movie or something. But if you're trying to maintain color accuracy, if you have a bright computer monitor and you've got the brightness cranked all the way up and the image looks great and then you print it and it's dark, it's not that the print is dark, it's that your monitor is too bright.
Right.
And colors can be off, and having the colors not where they should be, you know, even from the camera, the colors can be off. Your white balance could be wrong, and then the computer monitor might be too warm. Mm-hmm. And then that compensates for it, so it looks good, but then your printer comes out and things are too cool. And it just makes you pull out your hair to say, what is going on? Why are things wrong?
Yeah.
Martin, how do we fix this?
Well, I'd actually go a step further back than what you just said. I mean, yes, color management, the monitor being too bright is part of the problem, but I really believe that the majority of people's images are too dark. I think it's actually a step before, even in camera. If a lot of people are shooting with their images straight pretty much as the camera is metering them. And they think that that's okay, because when they get home and look at them on their very bright monitors, which is what you were talking about, then, yeah, they'll look a lot brighter. But I think that the problem actually starts in camera. And the majority of people, I had one guy about a year or so ago, not long after I released my 5D Mark II, 5D Mark III review, he emailed me. He was all annoyed, saying, you know, you said that there was no noise in this camera, but, you know, I'm getting really noisy images. And I said to him, well, send me an image. I'll take a look. And I took a look at it, and what he'd done was, I could tell that he'd basically done no exposure compensation, and he just trusted the camera's meters. And what that meant was that his image was actually quite dark. And I said, the problem is that it's underexposed. And he went off the handle. It was like, no, it's not. It was exactly how the camera said it was supposed to be and all of this.
Because the camera's always right, of course.
Of course. But so basically what happened was, I mean, if you shoot with the camera in its default modes and you never really take control of exposure, your images 90% of the time are going to be a bit too dark. And that's why I always shoot to the right. And meaning that I always, all of the stuff that I do, unless it's a really dark scene and I'm okay with having it a little bit closer to the middle of the histogram, I will...
Yeah, you're shooting to the right of the histogram, not like pointing the camera a little bit to the right of the frame.
Exactly. So the histogram will, the data on the histogram will be on the right side. And I always shoot so that it's just touching the right side, or just before it. But now with Lightroom 4 and what it does with images, I'm actually shooting so that I'm just starting to see parts of the image blowing out. And I'm not talking about specular highlights. I'm talking about areas of the image being slightly overexposed on the camera, because then when you look at them in Lightroom, they're actually perfect. And what that has two benefits, two big benefits. The first one is that you get much less noise in your image. Even with the latest range of cameras, the 5D Mark III and the 1DX, where you can shoot in ridiculously high ISOs without getting much noise, if you trust the camera and the image go a little bit dark, the darker the image, the more noise you'll be able to see. So shooting to the right is always going to give you the benefit of having less noise in the image to start with. But it also...
And a lot of people don't know, sorry to jump in here, but a lot of people don't know that as you increase your ISO, you also decrease the dynamic range capabilities of your camera. So if you're shooting at higher ISOs and you don't get the exposure where it should be in camera and you start to mess with it, then you don't have as much to play with.
Right.
And that noise is going to jump up and it's going to really ruin a shot.
Absolutely. So that's the first part. The second part is that if you shoot to the right... And then, as Don was saying, you darken your monitor down. You use the tools, your calibration tools, to tell you how dark you should have your monitor. And my monitors, I'm sitting here now. I've got my MacBook Pro in front of me with the monitor brightness is just under half. And I've got an Azor monitor attached to it. And the brightness on this is set at 18 out of 100. So basically, you know, everybody that doesn't take control of this is usually using their monitors set at their full brightness or around 80%, whereas half to 20% is actually really where you should be. And if you shoot
and
to the
Azo
right...
And Azo is like a company that produces like color calibrated to the nines monitors.
Yeah, these monitors are amazing.
And you still want to have it. And they're great monitors, but you still want to have it down at a lower setting, even on a good monitor.
Yeah, for sure. So that's it. That's your benefits. Darken the monitors down, and then when you print, think this through. You've got a beautiful bright image because you've shot to the right in the first place. You've done all of your soft proofing and everything like that on darker monitors, so you're seeing them as they should be. And then when you print, they look very much like what you've got on your monitors, because you're not falsely making it look brighter with your 100% brightness. So it all just works. And this was actually one of the major premises of making the print. Take out the guesswork, and you mentioned earlier about how, you know, you'll use up paper and consumables and stuff while we're trying to learn this a little bit about printing. But once you've got to the point where you've got it all down. And if you're doing this stuff with the color management and you have your screens darkened down, you actually remove a lot of the guesswork. And the only times now that I get frustrated with printing is when there's actually a technical problem with the printer. for example, I hope that you know about this, Don, but there's a problem with the IPF. You print from Photoshop, right?
I print from Photoshop.
Okay, yeah. So you wouldn't need to know this. So in Lightroom, you actually have to go in to an XML file. Not in Lightroom, sorry. When you're printing from Lightroom, you have to go into an XML file in the Canon, the IPF 6350's drivers. You have to go into a folder, find a specific XML file, and open that up and add a section in the XML file telling the drivers the exact build number of Lightroom. And you have to do this every time Lightroom upgrades from 4.2 to 4.3, etc. You have to go in and find the build number of Lightroom and tell the drivers exactly what that is, or it will totally ignore any color management that you do in Lightroom. So it's a pain. Wow. It's a pain in the ass. And if anyone ever buys one of these printers and wants to print from Lightroom as I do, make sure that you check up on this or email me, and I'll tell you what you need to do. But it basically, that has thrown me a couple of times. I've upgraded to Lightroom and I've printed and all of the colors have been off, and I think, Jesus, what's happening? And then of course I remember that I've upgraded, and then I have to go in and do this change and reboot the system. But it really, what happens is that although you're specifying a profile that you've created, I've got the calibration tools, I've created a profile, an ICC profile to use, I've told Lightroom to use that profile when it prints, I've soft-proofed using that profile, and then it comes out and it's as though it's been totally ignored. All of the colors are way off. There's a color cast. It's a mess. And I think, I've forgotten to update that XML file again. So you can tell when there's a technical problem, things are usually so far off that it's not a soft proofing problem. It's nothing to do with your images. It's usually something wrong in that you're specifying a profile that's not getting used or ignored. It's usually the frustration for me from printing comes from technical problems, not the actual act of selecting a photograph, doing a bit of soft proofing, and then printing it, because that usually is a one-step thing, and I rarely have to reprint because it's all set up so that it just works.
And we've mentioned calibration tools a couple of times here. What do you use? Let's take a step back. We talked about darkening down the screen, but there's got to be a more precise way to do that. And of course, a printer can have a calibration tool applied to it as well to get the colors and the densities and everything exactly where they should be. Mm. There are tools to do this. This is not something that you do just by eyeballing it and figuring it out, and guessing. You said that there are ways to take guesswork out of this.
Yeah.
What tools do you use? What's in your arsenal?
Okay, so when I was printing with a 13x19-inch printer, the old Pro 9500, I used to use the Color Monkey Photo from X-Rite, and that's a great little tool. It'll cost you about $400 if you get a rebate. I think it's $450 off the shelf. And I used that very successfully. I love that tool, and that's what I usually recommend anyone that's printing up to 13x19. But if you go to...
And it also does it does monitors, printers, and projectors too. It's a very flexible tool.
Absolutely. And the good thing about... I mean, it actually looks pretty dumb. When you first start using the Color Monkey Photo, it's printing these really big, clumsy-looking charts. But the good thing about... you only print one chart and it's got like 20 color patches on it. And people say, well, we'll talk a bit in a moment about the more expensive solutions, which literally can print hundreds of color patches to sample. The good thing with the Color Monkey is that from the first page with like 20 or 25 or so many, so a very small number of patches. But what it's then doing is it takes the results from the first page that you output and calculates what else it needs to improve on it. So it's actually it's much better than doing just, say, a total of 50 patches, because it's calculating the second 25 or so based on what it's learned from the first batch.
And let's say you've got an image, like I've got a couple of images that have very precise colors that need to be accurate.
Oh, yeah,
one of
yeah.
them I call the maple leaf flag, which is an homage to the Canadian flag with red maple leaves on snow. It's one of my most popular shots, but the color of red in there is very precise. And I want to make sure that that's accurately printed.
Yeah.
So what the Color Monkey software allows you to do is take a print and it will analyze the colors that are in that print and give you a separate a third or a fourth or a fifth, you can add as many of these as you want,
yeah, it builds
a test chart that it will then print and you can scan to add those specific colors to the camera profile.
Right.
So if you've got an image that needs some special attention, maybe it's because it's not printing properly or you're just being proactive, you can add those specific colors to its profile and build it to be more accurate because of it.
Right.
Now, it's a bit of extra work and you've got to know exactly why and where and when, but you can take advantage of that software built into it.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry, go on, Bob.
No, I was just going to say, when you move up to more advanced tools, you really don't have to do that because the sampling of colors is much greater.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, the next phase, and I mean, I bought the original, the i1, I forget what it was called then, but it was the i1 Pro 1, again from X-Rite. It's the longer... you know what? I'll put a photograph of a few of these different tools in the show notes as well. I'll just make a note before I go on or I'll forget. Photo of tools, and that could be misconstrued. so I'll stick that in the show notes as well. But I now use the i1 Photo Pro 2, which is again, it's the longer calibration tool, the big one that you'll sometimes see. And for these, you know, these are basically, they're $1,000, they're $1,500, depending on what you buy. But what they do is, from the start, you can specify as many pages, literally hundreds, thousands, if you wanted to, of patches of color to sample. I generally... We'll do a 3-page set to begin with, and so unlike the Color Monkey Photo, what you're actually doing here is you're outputting a whole batches of patches before you all in one go. It's not looking at one set and recalculating the next. You're actually just going to export them. You're going to print them all to begin with. And I generally would do 3 pages. I think it's 920 patches or maybe 100 and something. I forget, not 1,000 something. I forget exactly the number. But I print 3 full pages of patches to begin with. And that really, it gives you a lot of detail. The software can learn a lot about the colors, how your printer is printing its colors. And what it then does, it's basically like, it takes a red that, you know, it knows exactly the color that it's sent to the printer. So it's expecting a red of a certain tone and a certain brightness. And if it sees something different to that, it's basically creating like an English-Japanese dictionary. It's saying, okay, so I saw, I expected to see a red here, but I saw something that was slightly off. It was slightly more purple than it should be. And then it just remaps it so that every time it wants to see that red, it will actually send a different color to the printer that it knows will actually be printed out more red than the original would have been if you'd not had that little bit of a translation file in there.
And the same translation is required when you're calibrating your monitor as well, or any display device, and doing so with the printer, and making sure, of course, that your monitor is calibrated, and the tool that you have does the monitors as well, correct?
Yeah, it's the same thing. It does monitors, projectors, and it will. When you go for the Photo Pro, you can do all sorts. You can use the big charts and like the Color Monkey. The color checker passport is something that I often use to lock in the calibration of the camera from the start. But you can also
start way back at the beginning,
right? I mean, not for everything. I don't do it for everything that I shoot, but I'll often use that because it really helps to bring out like vivid colors and things. It really helps to lock them in.
For, Exactly. I use it for fine artwork reproduction, which is one of the services that I offer. And so you've got to calibrate from the camera. You've got to make sure that your white balance is tuned to the light source that you're using. You've got to make sure your monitors are perfect. You've got to make sure the printer is perfect. And even then, there's a, still a certain amount of guesswork based on the media that you're printing on with soft proofing. And so, you know, calibration is very important if you're concerned about color accuracy and density.
So, I mean, these tools are there. I mean, like I say, I'll put a photograph of the three. I actually have three. I'm a member of X-Rite's Colorati. They're a band of merry men that talk about calibration around the world. And so, I mean, part of the Pixels to Pigment, the workshops that I did last year are supported by X-Rite. And, you know, so they actually enabled me. They gave me a few extra pieces of that they're calibration tools that I probably wouldn't have bought because you only really need one. But they gave me a few others to use and show people. And another one that is really nice if you don't need to do printing is the i1 Display Pro. And these are all great tools for what, you know, if you don't need the color calibration of you know, the calibration or profiling ability to profile a printer, then you don't really need to go that far. But if you're going to do printing, I think it's really important to try to get a grasp of that. And at the minimum, the Color Monkey Photo will allow you to do that. And if you're going to go into large format, then I do think that the i1 Photo Pro 2 is the way to go. But it doesn't mean that you really need to. I do know people that print very well on large format using the Color Monkey as well. So, you know, it really depends on how much you want to take control. And I think at a very minimum, even if you print and you don't want to get this deeply involved in the process, go to the website of the manufacturers of the paper, because they usually, if you have a relatively popular printer, they'll usually have an ICC profile that you can download and use. But of course, that's generic. It's not been made with your printer, and there's always going to be a little variation. But taking control by at least specifying a printer profile made for that particular printer and paper combination, and then when you're printing from either Photoshop or Lightroom or Aperture or wherever, you just tell them not to allow the printer to do any color management, and you specify the profile yourself. But if you do that, it actually gets really easy. But the last step really that we haven't talked about very much is soft proofing. And I mean, what sort of do you use? I guess because you print from Photoshop, do you do your soft proofing in Photoshop as well, Don?
My images bounce back and forth between Photoshop and Lightroom. So during one of the final processes within that, it's in Lightroom. And that's where I like to do some of the brightness adjustments and the black levels adjustments in Lightroom, because the tools are more familiar to me and they seem a little bit more powerful to me. So I use Lightroom soft proofing capabilities, which as of, I don't know if it was in Lightroom 4 or 4.1 that they introduced it, but
From 4, yeah.
It was there from 4.
Yeah.
It is so much more powerful than anything else I had used previously. So basically, the reason for this is if you're printing on a gloss paper versus a matte paper versus, well, any media really, the way that black ink is absorbed, the way that, say, if you've got some dark tones in an image, like dark browns, dark grays, they might all look black on a matte paper because of the way the ink is absorbed, because it requires maybe more ink. Versus on a gloss paper, which will have a different effect. So even if you've calibrated your screen and it looks great, and you've calibrated your printer and your printer's working great, but the paper that you're using absorbs ink in a different way, you can use the profile that you've got for your printer and the profile from your monitor and visualize how it will look. Now, it's not going to be perfect. Soft proofing is not the perfect means to this end, but it will give you a good idea as to where those blacks are going to fall off into a muddy mess. And then you can adjust the brightness of your image, especially in the shadows, I find, in order to create the look that you're after in the final print.
Yeah. And I think the other thing as well to mention there is that there's some colors just do not want to print. Depending on the printer and the paper that you're using, there are certain colors, vivid greens and reds, certain tones of yellows. There's always areas in the gamut of a printer that
yellow's always tricky.
Yeah, and so you know what you need to do there is there's two ways I go about this. I use Lightroom for soft proofing now, and I print from Lightroom. That's one of the reasons I switched to Mac, so that I could print in 16-bit from Lightroom. But because I do the soft proofing in there now, I actually sometimes go to that HSL as panel and just click on that little there's a little noggin there, a little round circle with up and down arrows. And then you put it up, hold it over the area, because in Lightroom it's showing you the areas that are out of gamut, and you can just put your mouse over there, click and hold, and then move up or down, and it will increase or decrease the saturation or the brightness of the hues of that particular color that is out of gamut, and you can bring it in gamut. And if you do that in a such a way, I usually use the brightness and the saturation, or the luminance and the saturation. And if you do that in a certain way, you can actually bring it in gamut without totally making the whole image look really weird.
Because you're throwing it into what the printer can do instead of the printer guessing where it should put it.
Right, right.
And that allows you to say, okay, well, this image overall might have a slightly warmer tone, so I'm going to take this color and match it a little bit. Maybe I'll shift the yellow slightly more to orange,
yeah.
Or maybe I'll take the saturation and move it in a certain way that suits the overall aesthetics of the image instead of the computer just remapping it to the nearest neighbor that happens to be in gamut and then going with that. So it gives you that control back.
Yeah, and the second thing that I often do, and I call it flying in the face of the gamut gods, and that is basically I will take it the other way. You know, if you've got a red that it doesn't want to print, reducing, like I've got one photo that's a real pain in the ass to print. It's a basically a sea of red poppies with one white poppy in the middle of it. And the red, there are parts of that red that just do not want to print. They look like septic wounds. And I have to take that and all of the reds and I just send them through the roof. And in trying to recreate these really, really crazy reds, it actually drops back to something very similar to what the original image looked like. And if I go the other way and try to reduce them and get them in gamut, it just doesn't work either. It looks horrible. It loses all of the impact that the original has. So sometimes actually going the other way and increasing the saturation in the problem colors can make it a little bit closer to where it actually really should have been in the first place. So it's not always necessary to get your images in gamut before you print them. But that flying in the face of the gamut gods method will cost you a little bit more money in consumables, because you'll probably have to print it a couple of times to get it right. Whereas if you soft proof and get everything in gamut before you print, then you're often just right there. And one thing that I did want to mention here as well is that a lot of the time, especially with my wintry scenes and things like that, or even just, you know, if the image that is totally in gamut, before I print, I will generally just add about 15 clarity in Lightroom now. And that just sort of sharpens it up just a little bit. And it actually darkens some of the blacks down quite often, but it gives it a little bit more contrast that you sometimes lose in, especially when you're printing to a matte paper. I use the matte live canvas, and I'll often print to the Optica One paper. And what happens is it sometimes loses a little bit of the impact that the original might have. And so quite a lot of the time now, when I'm soft proofing, the only thing I'll do is add about 15 clarity in Lightroom before I'll print it. I'll often sometimes adjust the if I've got something that's out of gamut, I will play around with the saturation and the luminance, but generally it's on a per tone and per color basis rather than a global thing. You don't really want to be doing too many global changes or the image becomes something else.
The beautiful thing about this whole process is, you know, from the time when you buy a printer, you're going to be making mistakes and you're going to be learning. And it might be a bit of a struggle to get to the point where everything is calibrated, you know, the process. The only thing that might be image specific is the soft proofing. But everything else, once you know it, it's easy. just like learning your camera for the first time, it might be a struggle for you to understand the basics of ISO and aperture and shutter speed and how they all interact and understanding exposure. Mm. The same is true of understanding printing. It becomes almost second nature. Yeah. And you don't even have to think about it because everything's calibrated. Everything's set up. You don't have to worry about anything except maybe when something goes a little wonky or when you need to worry about soft proofing.
Absolutely.
So the process itself, I'm not going to lie and say that it's easy from the beginning because it's hard from the beginning. You're going to waste money on ink and test prints and you're going to spend money on calibration equipment and getting everything exactly where it should be. But the end result, like you had mentioned earlier, is having an original print that you are in control of everything from the choice of paper to the choice of every color to where things are calibrated. And the final result is your true, it's the end of the process of photography is producing that beautiful print and putting that on the wall and being extremely happy with the results. And I think that printing is the only means to that end if you do it yourself.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I'm gonna plug my print book here again as well, because making the print basically gives you all of the tools to set up this process, and it makes it, we almost called making the print frustration-free printing, because literally the reason that we shied away from that was really because there are times when you can get frustrated with it, and things just don't always go right, but it takes a lot of the frustration out of it. Just putting these things in place, it makes it a lot easier. I'll put a link to making the print on Craft and Vision in the show notes as well. And I know that a lot of people that listen to the show have already bought it. So it's something that you might not need to do today, but if you don't have it yet and you want to get into printing, it's a good thing to get you going, and it will take a lot of the frustration out of it.
And I want to mention too about books and that kind of stuff. I've got a book coming out and that's something that it's interesting because it's being printed. It's being offset printed, which is a completely different beast altogether. Ooh. We won't get into all the benefits and problems and frustrations with offset printing. But this book is going to be absolutely fantastic. It's on snowflakes.
Yep.
And so nothing to do with printing. But I'm getting the book crowdfunded. Because doing a large production run of a dead tree edition book, a physical in your hand printed copy, is not cheap. And that's why, big print houses will be able to have a budget to print, say, 1 million copies. Because when they print them in that volume, they get pretty cheap and they can make profit on it.
Yeah.
But if I were to, say, print this book that I'm planning on printing, which is about 300 pages, hardcover, detailing. If you haven't seen my snowflake images, Barton, I hope you can put a link in the show notes to some of them there.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of beautiful images, science and physics and even philosophy to discuss about this kind of stuff to fill up those pages. But if I were to go to a print-on-demand service like Blurb or any of the other ones out there, it would cost me just shy of about $200 to print the book to get one copy.
Yeah.
And that's just not acceptable. Right. I mean, I could print one for myself, sure, but nobody else could really enjoy it.
Right.
And so in order to do a print run of these books, it's going to cost me a fair amount of money. Mm. And you can help out by basically contributing $35 Canadian. So it's, a few cents cheaper if you're in the U.S. And that gets you a copy of the book when it's out in October, if the funding goal is met. And if the goal isn't met, well, then no book is made and I go cry in a corner and we leave that alone. But I think we're actually getting pretty close to we're almost at the time of this recording, maybe by the time you hear it, we'll be hitting 2/3 of the way there. And so we're making good progress, but there's still a lot of way to go. And if I exceed the goal, then the book gets better. I get to pay good money to good editors and other good photographers to fill out the content and to have the book physically larger in size and all that kind of stuff. So if you want to go check that out and support a grassroots project to do a self-published book, I'm sure you'd be happy with the results. And again, it brings it back to having, I produce hundreds of snowflake images every year. I'm not going to put them all on my wall, even though I want to. I just don't have the space. Yeah. But I will put them into a book and I will print them into this book. So please take a look at that and I hope you enjoy it.
That's all linked from the top page at doncom.ca, right?
Yes, exactly. So if you go to doncom.ca, so donkom.ca, you'll see a big banner through the middle of the page there that will link you there.
Yep.
And I do have a dedicated snowflake website at skycrystals.ca. And if you want to see more of the images, you can find some there too.
Okay, sounds great. So I remember, you know, we talked about this on Twip a few weeks ago, and I've been meaning to go over and get my copy and help out. So I'll do that. But to the rest of the listeners as well, just, you know, check out Don's work. The snowflakes are beautiful. He's an amazing all-round photographer as well. So do take a look, and if you want to support that, that'll be great. So Don, thanks so much for your time today. We've been talking for almost an hour and a half. So you know, it's movie length conversation here, and I've enjoyed it. I always enjoy talking about printing, and especially with someone that knows what they're talking about. So thanks very much for your time today.
You're very welcome. It's not a conversation that comes up very often in podcasts that I've listened to. So it's great to have this chat, and I hope a lot of people benefit from it. And don't be shy to give Martin an email or myself an email about any specifics that you might have questions on. I think we're both pretty receptive to answer them and pretty enthusiastic about helping out the community to get better prints.
Yeah, absolutely. So, if you want to get in touch with us, there's a contact form on my website. Just drop us a line. And if you want me to pass anything on to Don, or just contact Don directly. How can people contact you directly, Don?
Well, again, from the same website, doncom.ca, you can find me there. Yeah. I'm really active on Google Plus, though. If anybody tags me on there, I see it almost immediately.
Yeah.
So if you want to start up a conversation, Google Plus is the place to get me.
That's probably the same for me as well. I mean, because then the answers benefit not just you, but the rest of the viewing or the viewers as well. So that's a good bit of advice there, Don. Thanks.
I like having an open conversation.
Me too. All right, well, really, thanks so much. It's been a lot of fun. And thanks to everyone for listening today. Remember that you can find me as well on Google Plus and Twitter, and links to everything that I'm up to are on the top page at martinbaileyphotography.com, so drop by and take a look. And I'll be back next week with another episode. In the meantime, you take care and have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.